In the middle of a bustling market, a man rides on a white horse. On either side of him, vendors are selling fruit and silverware and silk. The horse clomps forward, dust coiling off the gravel into the air. The crowd parts. The man continues on until he reaches Jesus. He pulls on the reins, he leaps down to the ground, drops to his knees, and, after retracting the hood on his fine silk robe, looks up into the face of Jesus and says, "Jesus, I've been looking everywhere for you." To which Jesus replies, "You know, it's funny. I've been looking everywhere for you. What can I do for you?" The man, squinting into the bright sun, says, "Well, Jesus, there's something that's sort of been haunting me. See, I feel like for the majority of my life, I've only been existing. I feel like I'm only experiencing a shadow of the amount of love and meaning and purpose that this world has to offer. So Jesus, my question is, how do I experience full life? I don't want to just exist. I really want to live. So how do I find that? Where do I find it?" With nothing but compassion swirling in his eyes, Jesus looks down at the man and he says, "Well, you've heard of the Ten Commandments, right?" And the man says, "Oh, yes, 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 Jesus. I know the Ten Commandments. I could recite them all. Honor your father and mother. Don't steal. Don't murder. I've done all those since I was a little boy. So is that it? If I just do the Ten Commandments, and that is that how I experience the fullest life?" Jesus reaches down, squeezes the man's shoulder and says, "Not exactly. Here's what I'd like for you to do. I'd like you to stand up. I'd like you to climb back onto this impressive white horse that you have. I'd like you to ride out of the market and go back to the palace in the hills that I know you own. And once you arrive, I'd like you to go through every single room in this vast and impressive estate. And I would like you to, item by item, begin selling off every single thing that you own. Your four-post bed, all of your priceless oil portraits, your silverware, your candlesticks, your clothing, your tables, all your furniture." The man squints up at Jesus. He says, "Well, Jesus, then will I experience full life?" Jesus looks at the man. He says, "Actually, I wasn't done yet. See, once you've sold off everything in the palace, then I actually want you to sell the palace itself, and not just the palace, but all the surrounding property. All your acres, all your livestock, all your land, I want you to sell it all. And once you're done with that, I actually want you to tell all the servants that wait on you day and night to go and find new work." The man on his knees scratches his hair. With a crowd roaring behind him, he says, "Well, Jesus, and if I sell off all my possessions and my palace and all my property, I mean, then will I experience full life?" Jesus smiles at the man and he says, "Actually, I still wasn't finished. See, once you've sold off all your possessions, once you've sold off your palace and all your property, then I want you to go through our entire metropolis, every single block in the city, and I want you to shutter the doors of every single business that you have spent your life building. I want you to close the doors, just put a no longer open sign across the door, and I want you to stop working there. And then I want you to take all the money that you have accumulated from selling your businesses, from selling your property, from selling your palace, from selling your possessions. I want you to take all that money, and then I just want you to give it away so that then you can come and be with me every single day. So that then you can walk alongside me on every single road, every single path, every single neighborhood. So that way there will be nothing between us. And I promise you, if you do that, you will experience full life. I'm not promising you it'll be easy. I'm not promising you it'll be what you expected. But I do promise you that it will be full." The moment the words come out of Jesus' mouth, the man on his knees closes his eyes. And in his mind, in the darkness, he pictures a pair of iron scales. And on one side of the scales, he puts what Jesus is offering him. Life alongside him. Life with this incredibly loving and compassionate Son of God. And initially, in the man's mind, it seems like that's what he values and wants most. But in his imagination, item by item, he begins putting on the opposite side of the scales every single thing that Jesus has just asked him to relinquish. So he puts on his four-post bed and the scales tip just a little bit. And he puts on his priceless oil portraits. He puts on his silverware. He puts on his candlesticks. He puts on his palace, his property, his possessions, his business, his servants, his reputations. And before he opens his eyes, the man sees in his mind, in his heart, in his life, what he values more. And even before he says the words, Jesus knows what he's about to say. In the middle of the market, the man opens his eyes. He looks at Jesus and he says, Jesus, I can't do that. And you're asking for way, way too much. And with nothing but compassion swirling in his eyes, just as they were when the man first arrived, Jesus replies, I understand. I know it's not easy. The man rises to his feet. He climbs back onto his impressive white horse. He turns around. He rides back through the market. The crowd fills in behind him. He vanishes. And if you read the New Testament, the second half of the Bible, the book of Mark and Mark chapter 10, we never hear from this individual again. That's how the story ends. He rides away and we never hear another word about this individual. This individual referred to in that passage as the rich young ruler. He was willing to engage God with the majority of his life. Hey, I've done the Ten Commandments. He was willing to participate with Jesus in a lot of his life. He was willing to say, Jesus, I will engage you and follow you with most of who I am. The problem is Jesus wasn't asking him for the majority of him. Jesus wasn't asking for a lot of him. Jesus wasn't saying, give me most of yourself. Jesus said, no. I don't want most or a lot or the majority. I want all of you. I mean, Jesus is saying now what he would echo in the passage we've been talking about since we arrived in Mark chapter 12, when he says, here's the greatest command. Love the Lord your God, not with a lot of your heart, not with most of your soul, not with some of your mind, not with a high percentage of your strength. No, Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength, with all of your mind. And if I had been in that rich young ruler's position that day, all those years ago, in the middle of that market with my horse beside me, and if Jesus had said, Josh, go and do this and come be with me, I would have responded probably the exact same way he did. I probably would have looked at Jesus and said, Jesus, you're asking too much. I mean, it's just kind of over the top. I might have even thought to myself, Jesus, by asking for all of me, is just being unfair. And you know what, y'all? Maybe he is. I mean, maybe it's not fair that Jesus says, I want all of you. But then again, maybe it is. Part of my job as a writer is I have to ingest stories on a daily basis and on a weekly basis, and not just in print. I really try to dine at the banquet of narratives in every single form. So in literature, television, cinema, I love movies. And I really love movies of all genres. Documentary, action, drama, sci-fi, comedy. And over the last nearly 13 years that I've spent with my wonderful, wonderful wife, Kristen, I've even developed an appetite for the genre referred to as the romantic comedy, right? I know. Don't judge. Now, I will say up front, it is certainly a flawed genre. I mean, it's typically always the same story, and typically it starts like this, right? It's a girl in an elegant dress walking around with a parasol. She's on the wrong side of town. For some reason, she has a flat tire in her car. She walks into the garage. It seems empty at first until a man slides out underneath the car, grease stain on his face, and he says, hey, girl. He looks at her. And initially, they seem like they have nothing in common, but in the subsequent 22 minutes of the film, we realize they're really the same inside. And so they fall in love, right? Until the young man has to meet her father. He doesn't approve. He wants her to marry a lawyer or a doctor or a man that would one day be in Congress, right? So now there's tension. Okay, now all the happiness that we've seen through the previous 30 minutes where they're like on the beach and there's no clouds and Michael Bublé is serenading every single scene in the movie, now all of a sudden that is threatened. Right? Things start to tremble. And so we're like 17 minutes from the conclusion. And we're sitting there, and the directors and storytellers and actors are wanting us, the viewer, to actually think that this may not work out, even though on the box that we rented, it actually says romantic comedy, not tragedy. We know they're going to end up together. But so we're watching, and then finally, typically it's raining now. dripping through Ryan Gosling's beard, okay? They show up. They're at an old farmhouse for the first time in the movie. We didn't even know it existed. They look at one another. And then the man says to the woman, or the woman says to a man, they have some sort of exchange where it goes something like this. They say to one another, listen to me. We make no sense. We're so different. You drive me completely bonkers. You have so many dysfunctions and idiosyncrasies and flaws, and you are probably more likely to drive me crazy than make me happy. But here's what I know. Here's what I know for sure. I know that I would rather spend one day with you than a million elsewhere. I know that I want every single part of you, the good, the bad, the flawed, the beautiful, every single cobweb and every single enchanted piece of your soul now and forever until the day I die. And every time I see that scene, there's a part of me that rolls my eyes and I'm like, please, that's not the way it works, right? But I would be lying, and I think maybe we would all be lying if we didn't simultaneously acknowledge that there isn't something deep down in us that, if we see through the cheesiness, understands that the exchange they have just had is a reflection of the deepest and most profound kind of love. We understand that though it may seem cheesy in the film, love asks for all of another person. It doesn't just say, give me the good stuff. Give me the good days. It says, no, I want all of you. And when I see it in romantic comedy, I recognize it as love. But then when I hear it from Jesus, I just think he's being unfair. Is it possible that when Jesus stands, not just before the rich young ruler, but before all of us, and he says, look, I'm sorry, I love you too much to only get part of you in return. Is it possible that these aren't the words of an unfair tyrant, but the words of a marvelous, merciful, and loving King, of an absolutely incredible God, a God who knows that sometimes it is the tiniest corners of our lives that get the firmest grip and strangle our joy? Is it possible that these are coming from a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful God who understands that if we want to come alive in every single corner of who we are, then we've got to engage and walk with him in every single corner of who we are? But the rich young ruler doesn't want to do that. He says, I'll give you a lot. I'll give you most. I'll give you 90%, but there's this 10%. Of my heart, of my soul, of my mind, of my strength that I'm holding back for myself. And my first question to you tonight is, what's your 10%? What's that part of your life that you say, yep, God, I'm in, but not here? Maybe it's something as simple as being honest or telling the truth. I would imagine that if we took a poll, all of us in here would say, yeah, you should tell the truth. You should be honest. We go, yep, I'm all in on telling the truth, except when. It might not be most advantageous to me, unless lying may give me the outcome that I want. And we say, yep, 90% of the time, but I'm going to hold this part back. Maybe it's something like loving people. Again, I would wager that all of us in here would say, yep. I mean, you know, this is what we're going to talk about tomorrow morning, the second part of this greatest command. Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And I would wager that all of us in here would say, yes, we should love everybody. And we say, yep, I'm in on that 100%, unless it's this person. Like for me, I'd say, when I was y'all's age, I would say, of course, I should love everybody. But God, please do not ask me to love my dad, because he hurt me and I'm angry and I don't know how to look him in the eyes. I hate the fact that I see myself in him, so not him. So we say, yep, I'm going to love everybody, but not this person who wounded me, not my sibling, not my friend, not my former friend, not my former significant other who told me they would never leave me. Yep, I believe God. Yep, I believe we should forgive everybody. Yes, we should forgive everybody 100%. I'm all in 100% forgive everybody. But how can I forgive my parents based on what they have done to my family? And so I'm going to hold that part back. And I'm not going to stumble and fight to forgive. What's your 10%? Are you loving God? Are you engaging God? Are you participating with God in the majority of your life? All of your life? Allow me to tell you another story. I mentioned at some point, maybe it was this morning, maybe it was last night, that I have two sisters. I'm the middle boy. My older sister's 2.5 years above me. And I have a sister who's 2.5 years my junior. And back in 2008, I got a phone call from my older sister, whose name is Corbett. I was living with Kristen in Austin, Texas at the time. Corbett was living in Chicago. And my phone rings and I answer, and I can hear the excitement in my sister's voice the moment she begins speaking. And she says, "Josh, after a lot of thought, you know I've been wrestling with this for years, but now I really know what I want to do with my life." The moment she says it, I flash back to our childhood. In our childhood, my older sister had this ambition to be on Broadway. And in my very, very amateur opinion, she certainly had the potential and the ability. I mean, she was your classic triple threat. She could sing, she could act, she could dance. So when she tells me on the phone, "I know what I want to do with my life," I'm immediately thinking, "Oh my goodness, you're finally going to go for it. You're going to be on Broadway. You're going to be there in Cats. I'll be there celebrating your premiere opening night in front row dressed as a cat just to celebrate you. It's going to be incredible." And my older sister on the phone, she goes, no, I'm not going to be on Broadway." And I say, "Well, what is it? What do you want to do with your life?" And she says, "Well, you know, my husband and I, we've been married for 8 years and we've decided we want to try to have children." And the moment she says it, I kind of instantly slip into this uncle skin that I didn't even know that I had. And my sister and I over the phone were kind of dreaming up the picture of what we want this boy or girl to be. So fortunately and thankfully, my older sister Corbett gets pregnant. 8.5 months go by, and very, very late, it was probably around midnight, I get a phone call from her. I was in Austin, she was in Chicago, and she says, "Josh, I'm going into labor. Would you please come here and be with me?" Now, an important side note to this whole story, and I mentioned it last night, was it was only about 1.5 years earlier, and I mentioned this, that my dad had died. And my dad died in June of 2007. And actually, a few weeks after my dad died, my mom died of cancer. And so we lost them both very, very close together. And I know some of you know what that's like. And so when I heard my older sister on the phone say, "Josh, I'm going into labor. Would you please be here?" I didn't feel like she was calling on me just as a brother. I felt like she was calling on me to be her brother, her father, her mother, like our entire family. And so when she asked me, I said, I will move heaven to get there as quickly as I can. And so Kristen and I, we raced to the airport, caught the first flight. It was a red-eye flight from Austin to Chicago. We flew, we landed at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, drunk on Red Bull. We arrived at the hospital. I race into the gift shop just as it's opening, by the largest stuffed giraffe legal in the state of Illinois. And then we go sprinting through the maternity ward, and you see the balloons and you see the flowers and the blossoms and you hear the laughter and the celebration. And finally, Kristen and I arrive at my sister's room. We push open the door, and there lying in that cramped hospital bed beside her husband is my sister, and they're holding this adorable, perfect little boy named Cyrus. And y'all, like, and I know you know this, life can be so hard sometimes, and it can be so brutal sometimes. And I don't know what to do with that, but it is teaching me to savor life when it's so good, and not to be oblivious, and not to try to push fast forward when life is good, but rather to pause it and go, what does it look like to cherish this moment when I feel like I'm practically walking in heaven? And that's what that moment was for me. I just stood there and went, I just want to relive this moment for you know, the next 25 years. And so I went into the room, and shortly after that, my younger sister arrived. And so we're all there, and we're just kind of celebrating precious little Cyrus. And we're talking about all the things we want to do. And I'm like, okay, well, we got to teach him about these important writers. And yes, Hemingway, I mean, I know he's like 6 hours old, but you know, you can never start too young, and Star Wars, and you know, on and on and on and on and on. And we're in there, and we're celebrating, just having the time of our lives, until there's a little rap on the door. And I go, and I answer it. And it's the doctor, and he's holding this clipboard across his chest, and there's this nurse alongside him. And the two of them come in, and after a few brief introductions to me and my wife and my younger sister, the doctor looks at my older sister and Cyrus and my older sister's husband, and he said, "Hey, I'm so glad you're savoring this moment with little Cyrus, but I have to deliver some really difficult news." And he says, "We're not going to know for about 48 hours. We're going to have to run some more tests, but at this point, we're fairly certain that Cyrus has one of two things. And the first thing Cyrus may have is something called Down syndrome. And if he has Down syndrome, you know, we can talk about that. But I need to make you aware that there's a high probability Cyrus actually has something else. And it's called Edwards syndrome. I'd never heard of that. I didn't know what it was. I still don't really understand it. But the part that I did hear him say and understood very clearly is the doctor said, if Cyrus has Edwards syndrome, he in all likelihood will not live to be one. And the doctor comes around the bed and the nurse is with him and he says, you know, like I said, it's going to take about 48 hours before we know, but we need to run some tests. But as soon as we know something, we'll inform you. And so I watched my older sister like relinquish this child that it looked like she never wanted to let go of ever. And she hands him over to the nurse and the two of them walked out. And just as bright and joyful and exuberant as that room had been moments earlier, it was now equally filled with fear and sadness and tears and grief. And I watched my sister just sob. She was shaking so hard on the bed. Her husband held her to try to calm her down. I could actually see his arms just convulsing around her. And that's how much of the next 2 days were. It was me being there and going, I want to be strong for my sister, but I'm not strong. And I feel like I'm so afraid and I don't know what to do. And so when I wasn't actually in the room with her, I just paced the hospital hallways. This is oftentimes how I cope with stressful situations. I just pace. And so I'm walking the hallways. I'm drinking that stale hospital coffee. And it was probably around the 36-hour mark or so that a piece of poetry came to mind. I mentioned last night that I have a real affection for poetry, so I wasn't surprised that a piece of poetry came to mind, but I was surprised about the particular piece. Because as I'm walking this hospital hall, I feel like a scroll, this piece of poetry is unfurling inside my skull, and it's actually an Old Testament poet. It's a very ancient poet. It's a poet who in the book of Proverbs writes this. He says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Not trust in the Lord with some of your heart. Not trust in the Lord with most of your heart. Not trust in the Lord with the majority of your heart. Not trust in the Lord with 90% of your heart. Trust in the Lord with all your heart when you don't understand, when your heart is breaking, when you feel lost and frightened and confused. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. Don't depend on your own comprehension or plan to see you through. And so I wish I could say that the moment I thought of this little piece of poetry that I just went, oh, that's it. I feel so much better now. But I didn't. Because in that moment, I was struggling so mightily to trust God with all of me. I've always struggled with that, even since I was a child. When I was a boy, my mom, who was just an absolutely magnificent, magnificent woman, my mom would come into my bedroom at night. And while I lay there under the bed sheet, she would pull up a chair, she would sit down, and she would read me stories. I mean, all of these like classic children's books. You know, whether it was The Chronicles of Narnia, or Where the Wild Things Are, or Hats for Sale, or The Giving Tree, my mom would read me these stories, and my mom had this just profound ability to conjure a story in the room. It's like she breathed it in, and you felt like you could smell the dew she was talking about. And she also had this equally impressive knack for taking a story that seemed like it had nothing to do with matters of the soul or the subject of God, taking that story and eventually making it a story about Him. And oftentimes when my mom concluded our story time for the evening, before she clicked off the light and walked out and closed the door behind her, my mom would often say, Josh, you can trust God. God has a plan for your life. I was given my first Bible in 1989. I was 10 years old. In addition to a long note, my mom concluded it by saying, Josh, you can trust God. God has a plan for your life. And she wrote Proverbs 3:5. And what I never had the heart to tell her, even until the day she died, I never had the heart to tell her was this idea of God having a plan for my life never brought me any comfort. And the reason is because, and I mean this very seriously, my question was never, does God have a plan for my life? Like, is there an orchestrated way that God has intended me to interact with the world around me? My question was never, does God have a plan for my life? My question was always, is God's plan more fulfilling than mine? Because in my plan, my parents don't die. In my plan, my dad's not an alcoholic. In my plan, I'm not insecure. I don't get stage fright. In my plan, I don't fail. In my plan, we don't have financial struggles. In my plan, I don't repeat the same mistakes over and over and over. God, my plan is amazing. So can I really trust that your plan is more fulfilling, better than mine? I mean, God, can I really trust that loving, that deeply loving you and other people, can I really trust that love is more fulfilling than apathy and hate? Can I trust that forgiveness is better than bitterness? Can I trust that humility is better than pride? Can I trust that selflessness is better than selfishness? Can I trust that serving is better than entitlement and self-absorption? Can I trust that mercy is better than judgment? Can I trust, God, that even when I feel unlovable, you love me more than I could ever imagine? Can I trust that even when you feel far away, that even then you are in my midst? Can I trust, God, that even when I feel like my life has no meaning, that you see so much meaning in me? Can I trust, God, that even when life feels that if it has no purpose, there is profound purpose all the time? Can I trust, God, that the garden of scars that covers my heart can blossom and bloom into something significant and redemptive both for me and the world around me? God, can I really, with all of me, trust you? Can I? Do I? Do you? Do you trust God? What I am still learning is that trusting God is not just saying, yeah, I trust you. I find out that I trust God when I choose to do what I know to be right, even when it's difficult. Even when it doesn't seem most advantageous to me, trusting God is saying, God, I am holding on to you, even when maybe I feel like it might benefit me to let you go. Do I trust you? Well, that weekend with my sister, my answer was a resounding no. God, I don't trust you. And we crept past the 36-hour mark to 40, to 44. And right around that 48-hour mark, like the doctor had said, he and the nurse returned to the room. And when he came in, My sister's husband actually climbed onto the bed beside her, and the two of them held each other. And I was next to him with my hand on his shoulder, and my wife was holding my hand, and my younger sister was holding my wife's hand. It's like we're this human chain kind of going, whatever's coming, we're in it together. And the doctor's got his clipboard across his chest, and he looks at my sister and he said, we have the results on your son Cyrus. Your son Cyrus does not have Edwards syndrome. He's going to live. Now, he does have Down syndrome, so there's going to be some unique complexities. But make no mistake about it, Cyrus is an absolutely remarkable, beautiful little boy. And let me tell you what I did not see my sister do, not only in that moment, but in the 8 years since. I did not in that moment, nor have I in the 8 years since, say or utter or respond by going, God, why didn't you give me the kid that I had in mind? She has, rather than saying, God, why didn't you give me the kid that I had in mind? She has instead opened herself up, heart, soul, mind, strength, and hands, and said, God, I will fully, with my whole life, embrace the life you've given me rather than the life I wish I had received. And so following my sister's remarkable, profound, inspiring lead, I quickly fell in line. And I sat with Cyrus at 1 month old and said, Cyrus, Hemingway, this is important. And we talked about it, and I said, Cyrus, we're Chicago Bears fans, which means we never win. And Cyrus grew up, and Cyrus almost turned one, and right before Cyrus turned one, I got another phone call from my older sister. I was back in Austin. She was in Chicago. And she called and she said, "Josh, my husband and I, we know now what we want to do with our lives." And now I thought, okay, you had the kid, now Broadway, you, Cats, me, Meow Mix, celebrating you, right? And my wonderful older sister, she said, no. She said, we've decided we want to try to expand our family. And so now I'm getting excited. And she says, "Well, it's a little different this time. This time we're going to adopt." Now I get more excited. And she said, "We're adopting a boy from Ukraine. That place sounds awesome." And then she tells me, she goes, "His name is Vlad. I love him already." And then the last part she told me was to me the most moving and inspiring part. My sister says to me on the phone, she says, "And Josh, Vlad also has Down syndrome." Coming up on the screen here are a picture, is a picture of my two nephews. So on the left, on the left-hand side is Cyrus, and on the right-hand side is Vlad. And y'all, I want to make something very, very clear. We look at this and we go, "Wow, that's amazing." And it is. But it's not at all what my sister would have done if she had pursued her plan, her life, rather than fully embracing the life God had given to her. Sure, it might have been nice. It might have been easy. Maybe in some ways you could even describe it as being better, but it would not have been this. And these two little boys have birthday parties, and they have a whole sea of people that love them and hold them and squeeze them and give them affection because my sister was willing to say, "God, with my entire heart, soul, mind, and strength, I'm going to fight to trust you." Where do you need to trust God? I am not saying it will be easy. I am not saying you will get the image you have in your head of your life. In fact, Jesus never promises us that's what we'll get, but he does say it will be full. If what you seek is full life, then trust me with your entire heart, not just some of it. I'll tell you one more story and then I'll be done. In the book of John, which is in the New Testament, Jesus is in a dim room with his disciples. They're concluding a meal, food, drink. There's candles burning between them. Every little wick, like a fiery ballerina dancing back and forth, reflected in all their eyes. And Jesus knows something that his 12 disciples, whom he's dining with, he knows something they do not know. What they don't know is that in a matter of a few hours, Jesus is going to be arrested. And what they do not know, nor will they when it occurs, is that this arrest of Jesus is going to be a greater part of a plan God set in motion way back in the beginning in the book of Genesis, what we talked about last night. See, last night we talked about that when Adam and Eve ate of that fruit, the world kind of fell apart. And the reason is because when Adam and Eve ate of that fruit, sin invaded. Hatred, shame, selfishness, judgment. It filled not only the world, but the human heart, your heart, my heart, all of our hearts. And that sin separated us from the intimacy and wondrous closeness we were intended to have with God. If God hadn't loved all of us so much, he might have said, "Well, I'm sorry, that's just the way it's going to be." But God says, no, I love you too much for there to be a wedge between us. And so God set in motion a profound plan that would come to fruition through the person of Jesus. And Jesus, the Son of God, came to earth and he lived this wildly revolutionary loving life where Jesus said, "I'm not just going to love the people that are like me or who like me. I'm going to love everybody." Mercy, grace, truth, compassion, beauty, boldness. And he lived this incredible, incredible, like we talked about this morning, miraculous life. But there was this group of people, there was a faction of religious leaders who were opposed to Jesus. And so they set this plot in motion to have him arrested. They staged this phony trial at which Jesus was found guilty, convicted, and then condemned to die. Jesus was actually condemned to die, as a lot of us may know, on a cross where he's hung there, nails in his body, bleeding. But what none of those people knew is that this was all part of what God had orchestrated in order that that separation between us and him caused by sin might be redeemed. And that when Jesus died on that cross, all the sin in me, all the sin in you, the moment Jesus died, this invisible hurricane of mercy and forgiveness was poured out over the world, available for me and you to accept so that we might be redeemed back to the God that we were never meant to be separated from. And so Jesus dies on the cross. He overcomes sin on our behalf. He's put in a tomb. And then 3 days later, Jesus actually rises from the tomb. So he doesn't only overcome sin so that we can be connected and united with him in this life, but he overcomes death so that we could be united with him for eternity. And while Jesus sits there with his disciples, he knows all of this is about to happen. So this is one of the last moments he has to talk with them. And Jesus asks them a very profound question. He actually asked them a form of the question that the rich young ruler asked to Jesus prior. Jesus looks into the faces of these 12 individuals, 12 of his closest friends, 12 very flawed, broken, heroic, and monstrous individuals. And Jesus asked them, "You guys, do you really want to live? Like, do you want to not just exist and experience a shadow of what life can be? Do you really, at the deepest level possible here, do you really want to live?" And all 12 individuals, they lean in close and they say, "Yeah, Jesus, we want that." And Jesus says, "I'm not kidding. I'm not joking around. I'm serious. Do you want life?" And they go, "Yeah, Jesus, we want that." And so Jesus looks at them all and he says, "Well, then it's real simple. You abide in me." Now, this is where my imagination gets away from me a little bit, but I think that's okay. This is where I imagine when Jesus says, "Abide in me," I imagine John sitting across the table. And when Jesus says, "Abide in me," I imagine John kind of furrows his brow and nods his head. And then he kind of leans over to Matthew and he goes, "Did he just say to abide in him?" And Matthew leans back and he says, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what he said. Do you have any idea what that is supposed to mean?" He goes, "No, I'm super confused. I'm super confused." And so Jesus looks at these 12 individuals. He's just said, "If you really want to live, you abide in me." But he can tell. He sees 12 furrowed brows. He knows they don't get it. And so Jesus looks at them. He goes, "Okay, all right, my bad. I didn't mean to get all King James on you. Let me modernize it. Okay." And Jesus looks at them. And he says, "Do you really want to live?" And they say, "Yeah, Jesus, we really want to live." And so Jesus looks at them and he says, "Then you remain in me." And John, he leans over to Matthew again and he says, "Hey, did he just say to remain in him?" And Matthew says, "Hey, he's staring at us. He can't see us. He's God, you idiot. He can see everything." And so John waits a moment, and when Jesus looks away, he looks back at Matthew and he says, "Did the remain thing clarify it at all for you?" And Matthew leans back and he goes, "No, I feel like I'm more confused when he just said abide." Y'all, Jesus says, he says, "If you really want to live, you remain, you abide in me." And I have to think, in that room, just before Jesus is arrested, would die forgiving everybody if we are willing to receive it. I have to think that as Jesus says, "If you really want to live, remain in me," the disciples are going, "What are you talking about? What does that mean?" And I have to think they felt that way, because when I hear those words, that's how I feel. I go, "Jesus, what are you really talking about? What are you really inviting me into?" Y'all, I have really bad news. The bad news is I do not know what this means. The good news is Google knows. I Googled this. It's quite fun. Abide, remain, help, Google. And here's what I found out. To abide, to remain, it actually means, and I'll explain it, then hopefully I can illustrate it so we inch our way towards understanding what Jesus is inviting all of us to. What it actually means is to take up residence. So Jesus is actually saying, if you really want to live, take up residence in me. So now I wonder if in that candlelit room, the 12 disciples didn't get together and go, okay, let's just do a word association. Just, I don't know, Peter, what's the first thing you think of when you think of your residence? And Peter goes, well, this is just off the top of my head, but when I think of my residence, I think of where I wake up in the morning. And then Luke goes, see, that's interesting, because when I think of my residence, I think of where I lay my head every night. And then John goes, and see, that's interesting to me, because when I think of my residence, I think of the place that I want all my family and all my friends to come into. And another disciple says, see, when I think of my residence, I think of the place where I can go when I'm lonely and I feel broken and I'm hurting and I feel like nobody understands. And another disciple says, see, when I think of my residence, I think of the place I can go when life is good and I want to celebrate and I want to rejoice. And another disciple says, and when I think of my residence, I think of the place that though sometimes I may leave, I always come back. And I wonder if collectively in those 12 minds, they didn't start to understand that maybe, just maybe, Jesus was saying, if you really want to live, you make me where you wake up every morning. And you make me where you rest your head every single night. You make me where you want all of your family and friends to come into. You make me the place you go that when you are broken and hurting, and you feel like you are completely unlovable, that you step into me, and you make me the place you come when you want to celebrate, and life is so good and wonderful, and you make me the place that though sometimes you may wander away, you are always free to come back. I wonder if in their minds they didn't understand that maybe Jesus was saying, if you really want to live, you make me your home. You make me your home. Y'all, my last question to you tonight is, have you done that? And I want to be very clear about something. Jesus could have said anything. He could have said, if you really want to live, go to church sometimes. He could have said, if you really want to live, know some stuff in the Bible. He could have said, if you really want to live, then make sure you spend time with people that have made me their home. But he doesn't say that. He seems to be inviting us into something far more profound, far more life-changing, available for every single one of us if we would simply embrace it and say, God, I want to know what that means. In a moment, I'm going to dismiss all of us. But maybe for some of you, tonight is the first time that you embrace what Jesus has done for all of us through His death, through His life, the forgiveness that He offers for all of us as broken sinners. Maybe tonight is the first time when you say, yeah, Jesus, I've known a lot about you. I've spent a lot of time in church, or maybe I've never been around church and I hardly know anything about you. But now I know that I want the life you offer. I want you. I want to make you my home. Maybe tonight is the first time. Or maybe what you really need is to talk to someone. Maybe you feel, like I mentioned, I felt this morning that invisible hand just kind of squeezing my heart, going, lean into that a little bit. Talk to someone about this. Explore some of that more. Maybe you need to have a conversation with somebody. Or maybe for some of us, there have been times in your life where you feel like the rich young ruler, you've tried to give God all, but maybe you're in a season right now where now, like him, you're saying, yeah, but now I've taken a lot back. Maybe you have had other eras of your life where you felt like you had anchored all of you into who Jesus is, but now you're in a time where you feel like you've anchored your life 10,000 different places. Wherever you fall in the things I just mentioned, we are going to make this a haven, a space for anyone that needs it. Whether you want to make Jesus your home for the first time, whether you need to talk to somebody about what that means, or maybe if you want to return to making Jesus your home, we're going to make this space a place for that. For the next 20 minutes, there's nothing happening across camp. So if you stay in here to talk to someone, to pray, to wrestle with yourself or with God, you're not missing anything. But I am going to pray. And when I am done, if you want to stay, please do. There's going to be counselors all over the place who would be happy to talk to you. But when I dismiss us, after I pray, if you're going to leave, I just ask, out of respect for other people and what they may be processing, that you just do it quietly. And I ask that even when you get out the door, you wait a ways till you're a ways away from the building till you start talking. If you're going to leave, you just go back to your cabins. But like I said, there's nothing happening around camp. Let me pray. Jesus, thank you so much for your love for us. God, I am so grateful that you don't give me most of you. You don't say, hey, Josh, I'll give you a lot of me. I'll give you 90% of me. I'll give you 60% of me. I'll give you 40% of me. I'm so grateful that you offer all of yourself to me. God, help us to be honest and to explore and to be willing to engage what it means to give all of ourselves to you, to trust you with our whole hearts, to love you with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. God, to make you our home. God, for those of us that have never done that, for those of us that need to just kind of come back to you because we've wandered away, Lord, I pray that we would just respond to what you're doing inside of us, even if no one else can see it. In your name, Lord. Amen.